Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the writer, Sarah Gibbs.
Hello.
Hello, Sarah. Hello. Merry Christmas.
This is one of our Christmas ones. So we've sort of cheated a bit. Normally, we are kind of dependent on what someone brings in. This time, we force people at gunpoint to bring something Christmassy in, whether they want to or not, hoping it's something they also like.
Was it peanuts?
Peanuts, yes. You've got the notes, didn't you?
Something.
Yeah. So today, we're going to be talking about A Charlie Brown Christmas, the 1965 TV special, because it's Christmas and there's nothing Christmassier than that. And even though we could just sit here and talk about Sarah's work and Dead Ringers and MASH and Succubus and things, we're going to just ignore you.
Great. It's like being with my family.
Just think of us as some people who will talk over you and ask when you're going to get a proper job.
Brilliant. I don't actually do the Daily MASH anymore on the regular.
Moved on.
Yes, I have. This is just going to be a lot of me saying I don't actually do that anymore. Yeah, it has been a year of quitting things, mainly for bigger projects that are in the works, so it's good quitting. Yeah, I did have a month of that where I threw all the paid things in the bin, and then there was sort of a lag between that and the start of the next project. And I knew that it was going to start up again, but there was sort of a month where I was just in my pyjamas eating cereal going, do I work?
Because you're a grafter, you're a good hard worker, and it's people sort of think freelancers, it's mainly sort of, I don't know, lying in bed in watching Homes Under the Hammer and things. And people always talked about that. And I used to giggle thinking, I don't think I ever did that. Always worked.
No time for Homes Under the Hammer.
People I know who tend to do it tend to be performers, I think, because they're used to sort of having space between jobs and the jobs being paid okay.
Mm.
But if you're a writer, you don't really have many, well, you shouldn't have too many of those days eating fish on toast and watching daytime telly.
Also, actors are, because when you're filming something, there's so much sitting around. Actors are very good at sitting around, aren't they?
Whenever we go on set for something, I'm always watching the actors and how comfortable they are doing nothing. I think, oh, God, is that a skill you develop? Because I imagine if you were as needy for distraction as a writer on set, if all the cast were like that, it'd be awful, wouldn't it?
Well, in that month, I found out that's what Twitter is for.
Oh, so, right.
Yeah, true.
Just spunked out all of my errant thoughts into the Twitterverse and then enjoyed the barrage of abuse I received in return. Some of the subjects I talk about can be a bit contentious, and so I come to expect grief. I think there are people on Twitter who really thrive on the grief. They really enjoy the conflicts, and I think of sort of just, it's like a nasty side effect of a really nice drug. Like, you get your hit of like people retweeting you and engaging with you in a nice way, and then, you know, you might shit yourself for a couple of hours, metaphorically.
Yeah. I should say that at the bottom of Twitter. So side effects include nausea, dizziness and fascism.
Just to clarify, I haven't just announced that I shit myself on this podcast.
Yeah, no, don't worry. But we will edit it to make it sound like that's exactly what you did.
Great.
I might even put in a sound effect.
She's doing it right now.
Twitter's an interesting thing, or doing jokes on Twitter is an interesting thing because it's finding an audience, especially when you don't have one. People tend to do it when they're idle. Certainly comedians and comedy writers tend to use it as a place to put ideas that otherwise they'd have nowhere else to put. And it's a way of getting a reaction and a way of, when you're freelance and on your own, not feeling alone, I suppose.
Yeah, and also all three jobs that I'm currently doing, in addition to Dead Ringers, are directly from Twitter. So, I mean, you're putting stuff out there for free, but it's sort of like a job interview, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think it's great for people like me who don't get out a lot. Because it's sort of a way of being heard without actually having to get up on a stage or get dressed.
Makes that optional. It's a trousers optional medium.
Absolutely.
You do get work off it. I mean, you certainly have done really, really well. You've made amazing contacts by using that. Probably far above you would have done if you would say come along as a new writer in the age of weekending. Mm. And you would have been locked into a room with 20 other people, mainly men in cardigans, to come up with jokes about John Major, and then just jumped on a train back to the suburbs, and that would have been your social nexus as a new writer. And we know as writers how much a social nexus was so important to us at the beginning, getting to know people, going to pubs, going to meetings, going to social events. If you aren't able to do that for whatever reason, geography, social situation, having access to a wider comedy village must be vital.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it can be quite isolating writing, especially because you two write in a partnership. I pretty much write solo, and so a lot of it is sort of just banging your head against the wall and going, is this funny? And there's, you know, there's no one to bounce ideas off of, and there's no one to check. I mean, I send everything to my husband because he's going to sort of clap and tell me I'm good. You know, other than that, it can be quite an isolating experience. So sort of the instant gratification of putting something on Twitter and actually communicating with people, like getting work aside.
You've also done a really cool thing on Twitter, which is your thread about being autistic and about the things that people don't understand about people who have ASD, which is worthy of its own round of applause, frankly. It's good writing, it's good thinking, and it also serves a very good purpose.
Mm.
That was a compliment.
Oh, thank you. I'm so not used to those.
Has she been on Twitter too long?
My phone didn't go off. I was like, where's he going with this?
But you shouldn't have done that. It was bad. No. there's a connection here between sort of feelings of loneliness and feelings of being an outsider, being on your own, not being part of a community. And I remember rediscovering... I'd always loved Peanuts, but rediscovering Peanuts as an adult and looking at it and I'm being quite genuinely moved by going, I related to it so much as a kid. It was so important to me as a child. And looking at it as an adult and going, oh my God, it's about lonely kids. It's about kids with depression. The word depression is used all the time. It's about feeling an outsider, feeling that no one understands you. It's an incredibly comforting voice to hear when you think it's just you. And I wondered if that was something that had touched you as a kid or whether you came to Peanuts when you were much older.
Well, I came to Peanuts in a sort of roundabout way because we didn't have a TV growing up.
Oh, right.
Which is sort of weird for a TV writer.
Have you seen television since?
No, I mean, we have one, but I no one taught me how to turn it on. So it just sits there. But no, we had a monitor growing up, but I think my parents were kind of scared of it. They covered it in a silk cloth and put crystals on top. I don't know if that was to sort of ward away the evil spirits or if it was just so they could tell if we'd taken the cloth off and moved the crystals, which would be maybe giving them too much credit. I don't know. That's occurred to me since. But because we didn't have a TV, we had sort of Peanuts books and annuals and things like that. So I was introduced at a young age, but it wasn't sort of through this visual medium. Obviously, it was visual, it was a book, but it wasn't through this sort of easy to consume medium, I guess. Mm. And it was when I met my husband, and he had this tradition of watching the holiday specials at the right time, you know, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas.
There's a ritual calendar of Peanuts.
Yeah.
That's like a liturgical calendar, you have to follow it.
Exactly. And so that sort of became our tradition. So I only came at it with grown-up eyes. And I didn't have that sort of childhood connection to it. This is how I
So you saw the books first?
Yes.
You had seen the books. Did you like the books as a kid?
I did. I mean, I think I didn't quite understand them. I think I enjoyed the pictures.
Yeah.
I didn't quite understand these sort of very precocious adult kids, you know, speaking like little adults with these very high concepts in this sort of oddly juxtaposed innocent way.
Mm.
I enjoyed it on a level, but I think as an adult there's a whole other level that you sort of understand, and a sort of existential ennui that runs through the whole series that as a kid you maybe miss entirely.
I remember I had a friend who I used to get the bus to school with, and I was a huge Peanuts fan. And he said to me, I said, do you read Charlie Brown? I went, yeah, I do. He said, I've never laughed at it. And I was saying to him, no, neither have I. And he said, but do you like it? I went, I absolutely love it. And I think it was because I think I've got the humour more as I've got older. I liked Snoopy. I loved it and needed it and wanted it more than I laughed at it. I think getting older, I now find it hilarious, but I think it's quite a deep adult humour to get the references. So much of it flies over your head that even though you love it as a kid, most of it is aimed at adults, and it's not a children's comic. It occurred to me rewatching the Charlie Brown Christmas special, which is the first of the animated Peanuts specials that Bill Melendez and Lee Mendelsohn put together with Charles Schulz, that I don't think enough people talk about the line straight through from this special to The Simpsons.
Mm.
And what it is, it's naive. It's been produced quite quickly. It's TV animation. Apparently, they had 6 months to make it.
At the behest of Coca-Cola.
Yeah, Coca-Cola said they'd fund it. Apparently the version we see has got a lot of the Coca-Cola branding removed. For an anti-corporate, anti-consumerist fable, the fact that it's sponsored by Coke is just terrific. They were doing it so quickly, in such a quick style, which luckily suits Schulz's straight to the paper. He never used pencils. He used to just paint straight.
Really?
To it. Wow. Yeah, if you go and see the artwork in exhibition, usually when you go and see cartoon artwork, there's a pencil line underneath it that you feel a little, gives you a contact to the artist. But Schulz used to plan them roughly on envelopes and scraps of paper and then go straight to the page, which keeps the line very alive. But it's a very, very lively, very naive line. And The Simpsons has got that. It's a very lively, very naive line, but with totally adult concerns. What strikes you about this is it's not a children's cartoon. It's not Top Cat. It's not Danger Mouse. It's not got a childish... No one's rubbery. No one bounces around. It's not got the movement of Mickey Mouse or of Bugs Bunny. No one is a cartoon character. It's a sitcom. They're real people, and they're real adult people with children's voices. It's like Blue Remembered Hills or something. It's a slightly artistic thing. But that straight line goes through to The Simpsons, which is saying adult concerns, adult emotions, real characters, naive drawings, like a child might draw. And it's just something goes straight through that and speaks to you at your adult and your child, your inner child and your grown-up adult. I find that absolutely fascinating.
Incidentally, I know how you feel about all this Christmas business, getting depressed and all that. It happens to me every year. I never get what I really want. I always get a lot of stupid toys or a bicycle or clothes or something like that. What is it you want? Real estate.
I think there's a lot of that was sort of lost. I mean, we're talking about this Christmas special, but in later specials and the New Year's special and the ones that were made in the 80s.
Totally.
There's this massive tonal shift where the kids sound older, the animation is sharper. And there's a bit of magic lost in it for me when I think, first of all, this Christmas special, the original Charlie Brown Christmas, has so much space in it. There's so much room. They will just take their time over everything. Nothing moves. There's not really even much of a plot. It's just
thematic more than narrative almost.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there's long sequences where, you know, Charlie Brown's just staring out the window at the snow, or, you know, they just let him slowly walk to the letterbox. They let him take his time. And I think a lot of that's lost later on, where it's very dialogue heavy, it's very plot heavy, that it moves a lot faster. You can see that they've shifted it to appeal to kids more.
Yeah.
And to appeal to the times.
Everything about this special points to it failing.
Yeah.
Because they've made every single, in inverted commas, mistake you could make. Everyone thought it was going to flop. Made too quickly. I think there's a great phrase Lee Mendelsohn said, that on Wednesday they thought of the idea of doing it, and they said to Schulz, we need a pitch ready for Monday. So it's put together, and all that bits that were in that pitch are what the thing is. There's a Christmas tree, a children's show, Linus reading from the Bible. All the elements were done in those three or four days of thinking. And that all went off, and they didn't have time to have second thoughts about it. But the decisions they made, which were to run it off jazz, to run it off space and to leave gaps in it and to not put a laugh track on.
I learned something interesting this week, that drive-through movies, which are not a thing that we have here, but the prince of films for drive-through movies, if they were comedy, had a laugh track. Because if you're all sitting in cars, you can't necessarily hear the other people laughing, so it was cued on the soundtrack of the film.
Wow. But I think what's beautiful about this is that you can talk about the theory of laugh tracks forever. Laugh tracks are there to make it feel like a communal experience. Peanuts isn't a communal experience. You read that comic strip on your own in the newspaper. It's a one-on-one thing, and it's about loneliness, and it's about separation. The group in Peanuts, the mass, the mob, are mean and savage and unforgiving and can be turned round, which is the message at the plot. There is one, is can you turn the mob round? But Peanuts is an intimate thing. It's a beautiful thing, because that's where the art is. The art is in the one-on-one relationship, not in the sound of loads of people laughing.
I think that would have been incredibly jarring. I think I can't imagine what it would have been if they'd made that decision. Mm. I think it wasn't Schultz who said he just didn't want to tell people when to laugh.
Yeah, it was very generous. Mm. And oddly, the message of it, if people haven't seen it, the message of this is, it's Charlie Brown. The opening line is,
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel.
Charlie Brown sits on the wall with Linus, which is a snow-covered wall, with his head in his hands, looking like the weight of the world is on his shoulders.
I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
And that's the opening line of a feel-good Christmas cartoon special for all the family, sponsored by Coca-Cola. And then at the end of the thing, that question has been answered 24 minutes later, about what's the true meaning of Christmas and how do you avoid depression at Christmas. And it's so astonishing a thing to do, to say, well, okay, that's surely the whole point of the American Christmas special, is to fill everyone with sugar to the extent they don't notice they're depressed.
Well, you know, afterwards have a Coca-Cola, cheer yourself up.
Yeah, just a sugar rush will do. But it's so unsaccharine.
Yeah.
And the odd thing about this as well is that Peanuts is the most heavily merchandised and commercialised comic strip of all time. The lunchboxes and cards and Happiness is a Warm Puppy bumper stickers. It exists as the most marketed brand. And yet the essence of the actual stories is all about anti-consumerism. I mean, Charlie Brown is the kid left behind by the American dream. What if you can't be the greatest baseball player of all time? What if everyone just thinks you're a blockhead? How do you negotiate America's demand that you be exceptional?
I think what's interesting is that there is an air of loneliness, but also he feels alone in company because he is absolutely part of the group, even if they call him a blockhead, and even if they're all really pissed off that he's directing the Christmas play because he's going to ruin it. They still let him direct the play. They still include him. He's still part of the family. So there's something, I don't know, there's a sort of odd dichotomy there of, you know, this feeling of loneliness despite it all, that other people aren't necessarily the answer.
Hello in there! Rats. Nobody sent me a Christmas card today. I almost wish there weren't a holiday season. I know nobody likes me. Why do we have to have a holiday season to emphasize it?
There's the community is what, I mean, what's beautiful about the story is that it starts off with a kid and his best friend just saying, I'm lonely and I'm depressed. And the kid, the friend offering some advice, and then that friend staying with him for the whole thing. And by the end of it, all the community comes together on his terms. And that's the Christmassiest story of all, isn't it? That you're pulled together, that there is a community even when it doesn't look like one. Even though everyone sort of dismisses him and he sort of seemed to be invisible, and they run jokes about that all the time, no one actually hates him.
No.
And even though his dog boos him.
Well, Snoopy's just very mean. I noticed in these early specials, he's really mean.
He appears to be like the other side of America, the Joe Cool, the successful, the exceptionalist, the guy who reckons he's got it all. He's the brash GI who turns up and steals your girl kind of character.
He really pimps his kennel in this one as well, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The nativity play, of course, which is the centrepiece of the film, I have a theory that this is a nativity play within a nativity play, because the whole thing about Peanuts is that it is children voicing adult concerns.
Yes.
That's what a nativity play is. This is children playing adults.
Yes. It's, but they've always got a cotton wool beard on, haven't they?
Yeah. Sort of, yeah. Yeah. Some of the dialogue I thought was great. I've forgotten how well written some of the dialogue is here. You know, there are good gags in this.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
But there's also lovely lines like, there's one where it's just beautifully worded. He says, I'm in sad shape.
Oh,
I think that's nice. Great, isn't it? What a really nice way of putting it.
And my favourite thing as well in this is that the two girls who Charlie Brown is surrounded by, this is pre-Peppermint Patty, who's my favourite character in all of 20th century fiction. She will be arriving in a couple of years' time at summer camp. So we don't have Peppermint Patty, but we do have Sally and Lucy as the two girls who pull Charlie Brown in different directions. And they're both awful in their own ways. I mean, obviously they are heroic female voices, but the great thing is when he's asking them what they want for Christmas, what do you want? Real estate. That's Lucy's take on it. And then Sally, who's his little sister, who feels to be sort of the worst sort of America to come in waiting, that bratty baby boomer voice.
Dear Santa Claus, I have been extra good this year, so I have a long list of presents that I want. If it seems too complicated, make it easy on yourself. Just send money. How about tens and twenties?
Tens and twenties? Oh, even my baby sister.
All I want is what I have coming to me. All I want is my fair share.
Well, the little girl who played Sally was actually so young that she couldn't read.
Oh.
And so the director was feeding her lines and she was repeating them. And there's just
like
nothing...
Marlon Brando. Or Mae West.
Exactly. There's nothing funnier than a kid who's saying things that are sort of too old to be coming out of their mouth and they don't really understand what they're saying. You know, because my nephew, he's nearly two, and there's nothing more fun than making him say things that are just a little bit above his pay grade. Like yesterday someone pointed out that he was, you know, he's a stout little boy. He's two, he's spherical. Yeah. And I said, give him a complex, and he just goes, complex.
There's a brilliant line where Lucy says,
look, Charlie, let's face it. We all know that Christmas is a big commercial racket. It's run by a big Eastern syndicate, you know.
Hearing a seven-year-old girl say that is just... they're overhearing... You get the feeling they've overheard adults saying this stuff, like that kids do, like you're saying, the complex thing. But what's lovely is it gives them the voice of competing philosophies and things. I mean, Pinnis is so philosophical. It's a huge step forward in graphic storytelling to say we'll go for the gag and we'll go for visual gags and we'll go for character jokes and verbal jokes, but we're mainly going for competing philosophies. And the most beautiful moment is at the core of it is that scene where Linus makes a biblical reading, which was there from day one of the ideas brainstorm. That at the end of it, they'd go, Charlie Brown goes, I don't feel Christmas. And then Linus would give a biblical reading from the Christmas story.
From Luke.
Sort of suggested it, and they said, this feels a bit dodgy, this is a separation of church and state and all that sort of stuff. And he had a complicated religious background. He was raised a Methodist, I think, but very much over his life sort of moved away from it and became much more humanist. But he still has it in there, and he said, if we don't do it, who will? Which is a beautiful thing of saying, all the other Christmas specials won't do this. We're going to do the true meaning of Christmas. And they have that moment where it kicks in and Linus is lit by a really simple spotlight and they put a tiny bit of church hall, school hall reverb on his voice and shivers go up your spine. And I think possibly St. Paul's Cathedral. No, I think this is the best thing religion has ever given us, is Linus's speech in A Charlie Brown Christmas. I think all other things religion have done has been problematic, but this is unarguably a good thing that religion did because it reminds you of that communality, that shared values. I don't think it belongs to Christianity, this speech. It just says there's hope for lost souls.
Lights, please. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night, and lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. The glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, fear not, for behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Saviour, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men.
I don't think, I'm not Christian, but it, for some reason it takes me back. It's like standing in an old cathedral and suddenly thinking, well, we can destroy all religion, but can we just keep this building and that choir? It gives you that rush that Christmas carols give you. It's just, oh, that moment is one of my favourite moments in art, Linus's speech. I just love it's the reverb, I think.
The reverb is beautiful. And also, my favourite little detail is at the end where he finishes this beautiful, profound reading, and then he picks up his little blanket and walks off. Yeah. And you just remember he's a child.
The blanket he's pressed into service is a shepherd's.
Yeah,
a shepherd's cowl.
Great, that's a lovely switchback. That.
And also that lovely line where he said, "I'm thinking, what are you going to do when you get older? I think I'll turn it into a sports coat. And he'll be surrounded, always have his blanket with him."
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Charlie Brown and Linus are two characters, two child characters who have got mental health issues. Charlie Brown is a depressive and says so, goes to see Lucy, the worst psychiatrist in the world, and Linus is a philosopher.
Hang on, Kit, we've just gone past that, like that's a normal thing.
Yeah,
he goes, kids playing psychiatrists. We know that kids play doctors and nurses, right? That's the thing, because they understand doctors and nurses. These kids understand shrinks. Basically.
And it's also, I love the fact that it was based, Schultz said it was based on a lemonade stand.
Yeah.
You know, they put a lemonade stand and they sell lemonade or Girl Scout cookies or whatever.
And I love how shamelessly she enjoys the money.
Boy, what a sound. How I love to hear that old money clink. That beautiful sound of cold, hard cash. That beautiful, beautiful sound. Nickels, nickels, nickels.
I find Peanuts fascinating because it is a quintessentially American product to the extent that they put Charlie Brown on the outside of the Apollo 10 mission. It is so much. They are sending American values into space. And the lander was called Charlie Brown and the orbiter was called Snoopy. Either way, one way or other.
Oh, really?
It's on the side of the thing. It is America's big export to the world. And it tells you that they really have doubts about this whole America project. It's so strange for it to be so folksy and so down home. And it's called Peanuts, and it was originally going to be called Lil Folks, and it's baseball mounds, and everything about it is where I first heard about American culture. And it has total existential doubt about whether this is a good idea. And I find that incredible.
There's a gag in a later episode. Snoopy is trying to find out who stole Woodstock's nest. And it turns out it was Sally for a science project, and they go to Lucy for advice, and she sort of pulls down her psychiatrist's stand sign, and it's replaced by a legal advice sign, and she's jacked up the price.
This is the first time this has gone from... It's been a successful comic strip for a few years, and this is the first time it's gone to TV. Big jump over. And they doubted it was going to do. There were three networks at the time, and this got 50%, just under 50% of the TV sets in America tuned in to watch this.
Wow.
They thought it would flop, and it absolutely went like a rocket. But it just became a fixture of the American Christmas, like It's a Wonderful Life. Snowman over here. It becomes the... Christmas hasn't started till you watch this. I mean, certainly in my house, the ritual calendar's pretty much adhered to with this needs to be watched, this and Tom and Jerry the Night Before Christmas. Can't have you... And then the snowman. It's important.
Well, it's quite interesting parallels with the snowman, actually, aren't there? We've got the snowman, which is charming and everybody likes, but it is about a boy whose best friend melts.
It's preparing kids for when that happens in real life. Everyone at adulthood has had a best friend who's melted, haven't you?
And the other thing it's got in common with this is, and I'm pleased we're getting to this point, music.
Yes. Mm. Sophisticated adult trio piano jazz.
Again, it's adult music, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was in place from very early on. I think that was Vince Guaraldi to play the piano on it. I think Lee Mendelssohn had heard... Vince Guaraldi had a hit single called Cast Your Fate to the Wind, which is great to listen to because it sounds like the dry run for Peanuts. Said, just do that over the cartoon. And that, I think, gives you the motion and the emotion that it's quite hard to express in really simple lines when you're animating really quickly. So a lot of the emotion and the feeling of movement. That's why it's okay to just watch Charlie Brown go walk through the snow to the letterbox and back. It's because there's Vince Guaraldi playing underneath it.
It just goes to show, they say never go with your first idea, but...
I think it works.
Clearly you should.
Yeah.
If your first idea is a good idea...
Yeah.
Then you'd be foolish to adhere to the idea that you should come up with another idea.
There's that direct line to The Simpsons again, in that it established this sort of the music being its own character in a way. Like it's so integral to how you feel when you're watching it, in a way that I think well, obviously all soundtracks are in that way, but this really weaves in and out of the dialogue in a way that makes it feel like it's an active part of the storytelling. And I think that's something that The Simpsons picked up later with, you know, every moment Homer has a shock and you hear a big dun-dun, you know, there's...
Yeah.
The music is really involved with what's happening. There's something incredibly beautiful about the animation. It feels like a child's drawing, like you said. Mm. It's colourful and it's mesmerising. And they take their time over these sort of whimsical animated sequences, these long vignettes. And there's no dialogue. It's just, you're just watching this movement to music.
The big dance sequence where they drop in a couple of times with those kids doing those four or five classic looped moves. Which doesn't look like a limitation. It becomes completely charming. You're looking at a different kid each time. The one who's shaking her head from side to side.
That's true.
The kid who's shrugging his shoulders. They become... God, they should have a round and Strictly Come Dancing, which is Charlie Brown dancing.
Unless you're
doing the Snoopy dance.
That is how I dance. That is the only way I know how to dance.
I think one of those... I'm not very good on dance, but I'm fairly sure that one of those kids is frugging.
Yes.
I think there's a frug going on.
Is there a
Hully
Gully happening? I mean, it might be, yes.
Yeah.
What is frugging? I'm aware we're on a podcast, but please do demonstrate.
I'll draw it for you later.
I'll mark this one explicit. It's fine. Yeah. Kids won't download this, it's fine.
But you say each kid's doing a different thing, but in that dance sequence when they're on stage right before they begin rehearsals, there are two identical kids. Are they twins?
Aren't they called 3 and 4 or something? Right? I think I read that somewhere, that they've just got numbers, they don't have names.
But they're doing the same dance move, but just sort of...
Mirroring each other. But it's beautiful. That's the simplicity of it is... That would be in a Disney movie or whatever. They would be crossing over. There wouldn't be a single screen of them. All the decisions that would make that more elegant and more classy and more expensive, the simple, cheap version of it is somehow really satisfying. Everything about this should conspire against you reading emotion into it. You've got untrained children doing the voices. The voices are giving dialogue that's not age appropriate, that could be seen as quite chilly and adult. The drawing style is really simple. There's almost no backgrounds. And yet it makes me cry and makes me happy. The emotion of it is utterly unarguable.
When they go to the tree yard, that it just, I looked at that and I thought, and this is not a clever observation at all, but it looks like a Christmas card.
Yes.
It looks like a Christmas card. Apart from that one terrible, obviously Charlie Brown being the sad, pathetic outsider picks the sad, pathetic outsider tree as well, which then in good comic timing, he puts one bauble on it and it dies, basically.
Bends over and he says, I killed it. But also, yeah, he's drawn towards it because I think...
it's him.
Yeah, the phrase was, it was like his spirit animal, the thing that represents him, the unloved runt of the litter, the one who'll never succeed. And he says, oh, that's the one for me. And he goes, oh, your heart aches.
It's a decision he makes because that's the one for him, but he knows it's an unpopular decision. You know, he's got Linus with him as the voice of reason going, I'm not sure that's what they want. But he chooses it anyway. He's relentlessly true to himself.
Yes, he knows himself. I mean, the worst thing would be, I suppose, for him not to know. He's very, very aware of his limitations and of how he's seen. And it's painful. It seems to be agonising to him that he's much more aware of himself. The other kids are very unself-aware. Lucy's not very self-aware. Schroeder's lost on his piano. Linus is a clever kid. But a lot of them don't really think about how the outside world sees them. And Charlie Brown's curse is to know exactly how he's seen. He could go there and buy the flashiest tree and be that kid. But he's drawn, honestly, towards the tree that authentically represents him.
It's gorgeous. My favourite scene in the whole thing is, and I think this is such a bold move, is after Linus's speech, after his reading, Charlie Brown's walking home alone with his sad little tree, and he just stops and looks at the twinkling stars, and you hear a bit of the speech again. Yes. They reiterate it. It's just happened. But they just take that moment and they really just let it marinate and sink in. And it's only there because it's just beautiful and poignant. It doesn't serve any narrative purpose. He's just under the stars contemplating with his little tree that represents him that no one wanted. And it's the most moving moment of the whole thing for me, even more moving than the speech.
Times that for various reasons you don't feel Christmas because you're too full of chocolates or you're forced into company you don't want to be with or you're just alone or it doesn't live up to your expectations. And the whole message of the story is that the American consumerist machine ups your expectations of this one day to a point where it could not possibly satisfy. And then there's that simple child's voice in a school hall that says, there is still hope. And then from that point, nothing narratively happens. I mean, as a writer, you go, nothing changes except that the fact that speech has been said brings all the kids round. That's, I mean, it's a magic spell almost.
It is, and it's a sort of a, I mean, it was the first one, but later on, you know, they sort of changed it up, I guess, so that there were more cynical endings. You know, for example, the Great Pumpkin. You know, that's a terrible tale of like stark disappointment and broken dreams.
Crisis
and,
of faith. I mean, the Great Pumpkin you can read as a quite a savage attack on blind faith.
Yeah, and there's no resolution there. There's no sort of happy ending. They miss Halloween. Sally's very cross.
I got a rock is my favourite line in Peanut Special.
I got 5 pieces of candy. I got a chocolate bar.
I got a quarter.
I got a rock.
Trick or treat!
No one explains why someone who's waiting for children to come round has kept a box of rocks.
Not just one person.
Every house has got a rock. Charlie Brown, because the universe hates him so much, will get a rock. Yeah, so there's a lot more cynicism in The Great Pumpkin.
Yeah, I mean, this was quite a saccharine sweet ending for Schultz, really. But I think what's interesting with Linus being the one to deliver that speech is that Schultz has said that Linus represents his spiritual side. He didn't say religious, as you were saying. Yeah. He said spiritual, which I think It's interesting that he chose a religious passage. It translated on broadcast to have a spiritual meaning, and it connected beyond its religious implications, and it was moving for everyone.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
so what it's saying is that what you need at Christmas, that Christmas or any kind of big community or social festival is meaningless without some spirit. And that, oh God, that's what gets me. He goes, this is it, the promise of salvation, whatever religion you are, that you won't be abandoned. It's just, oh, it gets you. And that's the message of a special, which is not bad. Bear in mind, most other Christmas specials for children are about a reindeer who gets a special gift. But as far as Christmas films go, this is a pretty deep message.
I think there's something about vulnerability as well, because effectively what they're saying to Charlie Brown in this special is it's okay to be vulnerable.
Yes. When he goes to see the meanest girl in town to tell her his problems, he's happy to be open-hearted. It's his great gift. He's not closed off. And they're saying to him, well, actually, you were right, that being open-hearted, Linus has been open-hearted, that touched their hearts. They were listening to that speech in the school hall the same as we were. And obviously the rush at the end, when they all rush around him and say, Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown, is because they were listening as well. And it touched them as much as it touched you. As a piece of writing, it's nothing magic happens. No one finds the MacGuffin that solves the problem. But weirdly, the spiritual thing in the middle has answered the question. So someone online was saying, the interesting thing about the line of speech is that it is integral to the story. You can't take it out. If someone at the channel had said, actually, that's a bit on the nose, and you took it out, the story would collapse. It's not a bit of texture. It's the crucial incident. That's amazing. Put it in a place where you can't remove it without the thing collapsing. It's really ballsy. This is a cartoon, and cartoons are the product of many, many hands, so it's very hard to have an individual voice in a cartoon. And the credits at the end of this are quite short, because it's a small team who've made it. That lovely credit for graphic blandishment rather than animators, which is a lovely phrase. But it made me think of people like Oliver Postgate. It made me think of people who have made a little cartoon studio that's them and two mates. And it looks like it's a single person or three people's vision. It's had maverick decisions made about it because a small crew did it, so it's quite nimble and quite fast. No one argued with it. It's got that space and silence and craft to it that animation made for art house purposes has got.
Yeah, I mean, it gives the whole thing just gives the audience a lot of credit, which you don't find today. You sort of, if you put a joke in something, you know, the most common note you get back is, will people know what that is?
Yeah.
And you're sort of, I guess, pandering to what you think is the lowest common denominator or the audience's knowledge base rather than sort of just putting it in there and trusting that it will be well received, or that it will be, I guess, implied with context, or that people are educated. You don't get that anymore.
You know where you don't get that note?
Where?
Kids TV.
Really?
No. In kids TV, you can make the most enormous, esoteric, difficult references, and they go straight through.
because for some reason, kids
are trusted.
Kids are used to not understanding stuff. It is assumed that kids spend their whole life listening to references they don't understand, and then their brains learn it. But there's a misunderstanding that when adults hear something they don't understand, that they balk at it and vomit, and then just get really cross with you and run away. Whereas kids are used to, every day at school, they're given references they don't understand, which they're then meant to assimilate. Peanuts was a huge thing. It was full of references to politicians and historical figures and baseball players that I've got no business knowing. But I never went, oh, I've never heard of Willie Mays, so I'm not going to read Peanuts anymore. I went, well, I can guess he must be a baseball player or something.
Mm. It's the same with The Simpsons as well. That's
totally
another way in which in which Peanuts sort of was a predecessor. Simpsons completely just, especially in the early episodes, trusted their audience to just be like, well, keep up or don't get this joke. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, Mondale to Hart, where's the beef?
I don't know.
Means nothing to, you know, in terms of like most people's cultural references. But I would say, yeah, most of my education with pop culture references and historical references comes quite alarmingly and directly from The Simpsons.
Gee, do they still make wooden Christmas trees?
This little green one here seems to need a home.
I don't know, Charlie Brown. Remember what Lucy said? This doesn't seem to fit the modern spirit.
I don't care. We'll decorate it and it'll be just right for our play. Besides, I think it needs me.
I think one rule they've broken is really interesting, is that they've created a family with no adults.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, that's revolutionary.
Yeah, the adults are irrelevant. The adults are just trombones.
Well, in the first one, in 65, there's not even the trombone teacher, which everyone associates with Peanuts, comes in really late, that you start needing a teacher's voice. But in these early specials and in the early strips, there are no grown-ups at all. They're completely off-screen. You don't even get a pair of feet. It's not even the relationship that's in Calvin and Hobbes, where there's a mum and dad, or in The Incredibles or something, where the mum and dad story is as important. And people always talk that about kids won't watch something without other kids in it, because that's their point of entry. But a lot of grown-ups won't watch something without grown-ups in. That's how Pixar got around it. They always put Andy's mom in there, or Andy as a surrogate dad in Toy Story. So there's a parent's view. But Peanuts doesn't have a parent's eye view in it. You've just got to get down there on the floor with the kids. Even though Peanuts exists as a commercial entity, and a very successful commercial entity, the Peanuts that Schultz is doing, that his pen makes and his mind makes, somehow remains something completely separate and apart from that. And it's probably because he did it on his own right until he died. And he never did what Jim Davis, who did Garfield, did. He never got a team of people in to draw it. It was always him from his brain to the page straight away. He owned it completely. It was never an industrialised process making the strips. So it does feel like his voice.
He wrote that beautiful farewell letter to his characters when he decided to stop doing, when he wasn't well enough to do the strips anymore.
Oh, I wasn't aware of this.
I'll see if I can find it. Might take a second.
Yeah.
Dear friends, I have been fortunate to draw Charlie Brown and his friends for almost 50 years. It has been the fulfilment of my childhood ambition. Unfortunately, I am no longer able to maintain the schedule demanded by a daily comic strip. My family does not wish Peanuts to be continued by anyone else, therefore I am announcing my retirement. I have been grateful over the years for the loyalty of our editors and the wonderful support and love expressed to me by fans of the comic strip. Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Linus, Lucy. How can I ever forget them? Charles M. Schultz.
That's lovely. That's giving me a shiver.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, one and all.
Do, do, do.
Let's all sing. Beautiful. Obviously, the only thing that remains to say after that is thank you very much, Sarah Gibbs.
Thank you, Sarah.
For having me.